This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
BFM 89.9, I'm Sharad Kutin, and with me, Brian Fernandez. This is the morning run, and we continue on till 10 a.m. this morning. A little short of the results of the British polls, but I expect, some of the results will be coming in about 15 minutes. It's exciting partly because of its implications for the European Union and negotiations between Britain and the EU. Brian, are you interested at all in this particular election?
Actually, a lot less than before. It seems to be that Theresa May has kind of lost this election. I mean, she's going to win it, I think, or it could be a hung parliament. But the whole implications on the EU has less relevance to Malaysia now. You know, they're the old colonial power. But really, for us, relevance is now China, still US, and of course, places like India and ASEAN.
But what about the question of trade? We trade with both Britain and the rest of the EU, and we've signed, agreements with the collective member states of the EU. When Britain pulls away, it's going to have to renegotiate its relationship to a whole host of countries, including Malaysia, and also, you know, the investments that we have in Britain may be based on the idea of passporting. May you locate in Britain, and you can then deal with the rest of Europe. That's going to end, presumably, with the breakup of Britain and the EU. So there are implications for Malaysian trade, aren't there?
Yes, they are. And I think that in the past, while they have leveraged on old colonial ties and the old ties of people going to study in the UK and so forth, now when they have to renegotiate these trades on a bilateral level, and Malaysia included, I think they have to take a different slant to it and be perhaps a little bit more aggressive. I think that the UK needs to, for example, to use one specific example of India. The UK has not leveraged on its old relationships with India in a manner that it has perhaps leveraged on that with its trade ties with Saudi Arabia and all the large arms deals it's done over the years.
Yeah, all kinds of interesting implications, which is why I think we're covering this election this morning. And also, after the 8:30 news, we'll be going to an expert on British politics to get a deeper insight into the elections and its implications. Now, also, Brian, we have today on the Breakfast Grill a deep dive into halal and halal parks. That's a Breakfast Grill that I do with Muhammad Noor Abdul Salam, CEO of UM Land J Biotech Park.
Yeah, I'm looking
Johor
forward
halal.
To that.
Are you? Why? Yeah. Why are you looking forward to that?
I think, you know, the whole thing of halal, again, you talk about opportunities for Malaysia. That's an opportunity we have not leveraged on sufficiently. We had an early start into recognizing that the opportunity was there for halal exports. But unfortunately, we were long on ideas, short on execution. We've done reasonably well. We could have done a lot better.
So Johor Halal Park will be the 25th halal park in the country, but it aims to be the gold standard and 100% halal park. Apparently, there are gradations of halal parks. Also, not to forget the continuing siege of Qatar and Marawi City. That Marawi City siege in southern Philippines has not ended. The Philippine forces said they would be able to take back the city last week. That hasn't happened. That did not happen. This week, they said again, by the end of this week, they'd be able to take back the city. We don't know if it's going to happen. We're looking perhaps at a long-term, protracted war there, or battle, if you like, in Marawi City, and its implications for the rest of the region are stunning, including, if you noted yesterday, Brian, the conclusion of the Lahad Datu trial. Nine Filipino nationals are going to be put to the death for waging war against the Agong is the charge, I believe.
Yep.
So we're going to be back. Also, just before we forget, the weather, I actually have no idea what the weather is. It goes from torrential rain to scorching heat, often in a day, in a single afternoon. You have it.
But then again, this is the whole implications of climate change. Our weather patterns are no longer predictable.
So after this, we have Blondie and The Tide Is High, BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, that was The Tide is High by Blondie. You know, it's the front person, front man, as it were, for Blondie, of course, is Debbie Harry, one of my favorite singers from the 80s. Now, just to keep us talking about the ongoing UK polls, exit polls have already suggested that the Conservative Party, the party, the incumbents, are going to have the largest number of seats, but short of a simple majority, as we call it in Malaysia, or overall majority, as they call it in Britain. So they're not going to have enough to govern, maybe pass legislation without the help of other parties. An interesting prospect. This is just the exit polls and also exit polls. On news from the exit polls, Brian, there was a drop in the sterling. So there are already implications, even without the full results.
Yeah, and I think that here's what it boils down to. It's all about uncertainty and how we're going to move forward, because the UK has, with Brexit, quite significant political tasks that need to do, you know, and timelines. How do you do that with a hung parliament?
Well, you know, so this isn't necessarily a hung parliament, right? So a hung parliament is when there's no clear leadership. The Tories could still take control. They could be the minority government, meaning they're governing with the support of, and you know, support in terms of confidence in their government going forward. An absolute kind of hung parliament, which is a scenario I think that was laid out the last general elections, would have actually made it close to impossible to set up a government. This was, it would have had to, they would have had to be coalitions and such. So are we looking at that scenario? We don't know yet, but remember, after the 8:30 news, we are going to be speaking to an expert on that question. We often, Brian, though, talk about ourselves. And, you know, I sometimes find myself being annoyed with people who talk about themselves.
Or rather, to themselves. Yeah, well, so you're always annoyed with people like me.
Do you talk to yourself?
Absolutely. And growing up, I was always quite conscious about it because people would point it out.
But you would talk audibly
yeah.
To yourself?
Softly, of course.
Oh, you talk softly to yourself. You didn't shout yourself.
Yeah.
And what were you talking to yourself about?
Well, basically, the crux of the article lays it out entirely, the reasons why I do it. One of the key things is really the article talks about the need to look at things objectively. So when I'm faced with a scenario, sometimes I talk out the different options. So absolutely right. I look at things far more objectively. Secondly, also, it's to reduce anxiety. So if I've got a difficult decision to make, a lot of times I will talk myself through it. The third way I talk to myself is also when I do role play or scenario play. So if I'm about to make a speech, that's something that I would go through. Sometimes I would even, when going through a difficult conversation or an antagonistic conversation, I would do a role play and talk to myself. So various elements on talking to myself.
Did you learn this from somebody?
No, actually not. It just evolved over the years.
So this is interesting. I've read about this phenomena, which I think psychologists are trying to understand. There's research on it. I read it in the New York Review of Books. There's a whole field of study around this kind of inner voice and speaking to yourself. And what does it suggest about consciousness? We all assume that we are one integrated person and that all, you know, and therefore there's no need to talk to yourself because there are multiple selves to talk to. But we actually might be constituted of multiple selves, in which case the whole question of identity becomes much, much more complex. I know people who talk to themselves. I don't think I ever engage in that myself.
How about for motivation? Didn't you talk to yourself to psych yourself up before an event or something like that?
Yeah, well, so the question is, would I do that? And so would I actually say, oh, Sharad, you've got to do this. You know, you've got to reach
the finish line. I actually do that.
Well, I wouldn't do that. I might visualize. So there was a time in my life when I was a bit more active physically and I would go for a run and I'd always imagine the entire route. And that was very important to me. And perhaps when exhaustion set in at some point in the run, I would say, okay, you're going to get to the next curve or the next bend. But I never, I don't think, did it audibly. Or I could have. Maybe I'm suppressing the memory of this. So what else is this article? We're going to try and tweet out the article, which it comes from the New York Times. It says, the benefits of talking to yourself. Because clearly this is one of those articles that's already come down on one side of the debate, suggesting that this is a good thing, as opposed to one that lays out some of the pros and cons. There are a lot of societies. You said, Brian, just now that you were criticized for this. Who criticized you?
Absolutely, because I think society and Malaysians, I mean, if you're just walking down the street, for example, and you see someone talking to yourself, oh, siawa, you know, mad fella, whatever, that's the first thing that comes to mind. Rather than, oh, he's trying to rationalize an argument, I don't think that comes naturally.
But the question is, why does it have to be done audibly? What do you have to sound it out? Could you just have that conversation in your head?
Okay, so sometimes when it's not convenient, that conversation in my head happens in combination with writing it down. So I'm having that conversation and I'm writing it down. So I'm visually representing my thoughts, and that helps my thought process.
Oh, okay. Would you have any other tips for people who want to, you know, think better? Because I think a lot of times we talk about the substance of our thoughts. We talk about what we're thinking about rather than the process. And, you know, we don't spend enough time talking about thinking or thinking about thinking, yeah, as it were.
So one of the things I've realized at Dunsith, it really helps with clarity of thought. If you're in a situation where there's a lot of ambiguity, or your thoughts are muddled because you're angry, you're very sad, oh, it really helps you. That process really, really helps you.
You know, somebody listening to this talk might call you a sunshine Superman. Meaning you're so full of positive energy. But
at 6 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah, but that's the title of the next song by Donovan on BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, I'm Shohat Kutin, with me, Brian Fernandez, and the morning run chugs along. This is what we call the 6 a.m. stretch. And we're heading into, for most of us, a long weekend. It's Saturday, Sunday, and Monday. Now, Monday being Nuzul Quran, I believe it's the holiday, the reason for. I think a lot of good cheer. A long weekend is always welcome, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. What are you planning to do, Shohrad?
Well, you know, I'm planning to do nothing, absolutely nothing, at least the first 36 hours. And then I might get up and, you know, do some housework and sort things out. Maybe have a long lunch. I like long lunches. And I think Sunday might be the perfect day to have a long lunch with good friends over good food. And
hopefully good weather as well.
Yes, good weather, but you know, the great thing about the apartment I live in, it comes with a roof on top, and so it is weatherproof. It's just getting my friends in, that is going to be a bit of a trick because there's no parking in my apartment. You know, a lot of us talk about consumption on this show, because on BFM, we often talk about how we spend our money, not just making money, but how we spend our money. Yesterday on the Ring and Sense show, we talked about lavish spending. And there's some recent surveys about lavish spending. But they're changing. There's a changing character in lavish spending or consumption, conspicuous consumption, isn't there, Brian?
Yes, and this article in Quartz basically outlines the fact that particularly with the elites, consumption patterns have changed. So it brings to light Thorsten Veblen. So this brings me back 28 years ago to Economics 101. And Thorsten Veblen talked about the theory of the leisure classes, which is he identified at that time corsets and silver spoons. So this is where the whole term of born with a silver spoon came about, and how the elite classes, and that was their consumption at the time. For the longest time, we would associate things like Bentleys and Lamborghinis and stuff as consumption with the leisure classes. This article actually brings to light a change or a significant shift in consumption patterns of the leisure classes, or the elite classes rather, into that of really trying to build on cultural capital and prizing knowledge and price knowledge.
What does that mean?
So basically what they're doing is they are spending on more education, human capital investment, so it really investing in themselves, and services.
But you know, that's really strange. It sounds almost counterintuitive. I imagine the leisure classes, the elite, have, you know, they've had their schools, they've had their public schools, the Eatons, and, you know, and the Ivy League schools for themselves. For, you know, over a century now, they, you know, they've created institutions. And, you know, I can't imagine them only now thinking about good food. They've always had good food. So, I mean, that, if I get the argument correct, am I mistaken?
I think it's all about, you know, differentiating themselves also from the mass market. I think that's part of the whole equation. Today, the middle class is buying LV bags, BMWs, Mercedes, and so forth. It's everywhere. It's no longer a symbol of wealth.
Right. So then they go to the those handbags that are higher priced. I don't know, the Marc Jacobs or the Birkin bags or whatever it is, right? Just so you differentiate, but that's just a question of moving from product to product, right?
But in this article, it brings out about a whole shift in thinking. Well, it's shifted my thinking in terms of them spending more on experiences in terms of or education. So, for example, I think for even though they may have, say, 15 years ago gone to university, they are investing more in executive education. Say, going back to Harvard or going to Stanford and doing a 6-week advanced management program and so forth. Really, really expensive program. So a 6-week program at Stanford will set you back $60,000.
So that's lunch, is it? That's lunch money for the 1%.
Yeah, but
I still don't get this. You know, in some ways, I don't get this article because I imagine they've always availed themselves of the best, right? So now there's some shifting fashions, executive, mid-career executive type education programs or courses are also available for the middle classes. I mean, you know, in fact, in a place like Malaysia, the government puts aside money or forces companies to put aside money in the Human Resource Development Fund. And you can use that money, your companies can use that money to send you for you know, one of these mid-career things. In fact, BFM has one called the B School, right?
Yeah, yeah. And that's an excellent
set
program.
You back. Yeah. And that sets you back, you know, a couple of tens of thousands. So, you know, so what is it really saying? I mean, this article really saying about the question of elite spending?
And I think it's, again, back to talking about, and I don't completely agree with the article. In fact, I more agree with you. Now, instead of buying Bentleys and Rolls Royces, they've already got it. That's fine. So they're looking at the other stuff, the unique experiences. So I think I'll use an example of what I think an elite would want to do. They'd spend probably, 200,000 to go on an African safari and bring all their friends along with them. And that's an elite experience that the middle classes are completely caught out of. I mean, when you bring your whole entourage and stuff, that's hundreds and hundreds of thousands. So very different experiences, very personalized experiences.
Yeah, so but what the article tries to argue for ultimately is the expression inconspicuous consumption. I, like you, Brian, still a bit skeptical about that, but it's a discussion for another day. Next up, we have Deep Blue Something with Breakfast at Tiffany's, BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, that was Indigo Girls with Closer to Fine. I'm sure it couldn't with me, Brian Fernandez. And news trickling in from Britain because of their general elections. They go to the polls and the polls have come to a close. And some of the election results, only two of the 650 seats up for grabs have been called so far, both of them going to Labour. Brian, very quickly, we just some numbers for you on what's at stake. 650 seats, as I said before. The finishing line for any party to take control of Parliament as a single party is 326. Now, exit polls suggest that the Conservative Party, the incumbents, will get only 314, 12 seats short of an absolute majority. And the remaining major parties, the Labour, SNP and Lib Dems, constitute or together in the exit poll will get something of the same magnitude, of 314 as well. The remaining 22 going to the Welsh Party, the Greens and other parties. We're looking possibly at a repeat of 2010 when there was a hung parliament that resulted in a coalition government of Conservatives and Liberal Democrats. So that's the state of play at the moment with the UK elections.
Well, leading on from that, just before the polls, we spoke to Ian Begg, research fellow at the European Institute, London School of Economics, and we asked him what were the most pertinent questions that are in the minds of voters, and also then how did he feel the influence on the outcome of the elections would be?
Well, UK general elections have always focused on three main things: the economy, the approach to the National Health Service, the NHS, which for many in Britain is regarded as close to a religion rather than a political issue, and the competence of leaders. Although the election was called as an attempt to establish exactly what approach Britain would take to leaving the European Union, comparatively little attention has been paid in this campaign to the Brexit issue and has reverted to those standard things: the public services, particularly health services, and the approach to the economy, as well as the approaches of the leaders.
We also asked Ian Begg what the likely outcome was from this election.
It's quite hard to tell, based on the evidence coming from opinion polls, who's going to win. Although the lead for the Conservative Party has been consistent throughout, all the polls are saying the Conservative Party has a lead. Where they disagree is on the extent of the lead. Therefore, the most obvious bet to make is that the Conservative Party will win, possibly with a somewhat bigger majority, but there's a degree of uncertainty around whether it will gain or even possibly, in the extreme case, lose some seats while remaining the biggest party.
That was Ian Begg, research fellow, London School of Economics.
Yeah, so, you know, again, what is really interesting about what he said in the start there, in the first clip that you played, was the fact that this was expected to be a Brexit election, meaning this was about giving Theresa May, head of the Conservative Party, the incumbent government, the mandate to negotiate tough with the European Union. It's, in fact, reverted, as Ian suggested, to a discussion of domestic policy, social policy in particular, that's become quite a hot potato. I don't know if you saw this encounter between Boris Johnson, who's the foreign secretary, with a fortune teller, a British fortune teller, and when he asked who's going to win, and her partner says something to the effect that the Labour will win, and then he says to the woman, you know, you're the professional fortune teller, tell me what. She says, well, for that you have to pay me. You're already ruining social services. You're taking away my pension. Now you want to get a fortune told without paying me. It was a brilliant moment. It went viral. Brilliant stuff. We're going to be back, Brian, with more discussion on the UK elections. Coming up now, Santana with Oi Como Va, BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, that was Santana with Oi Como Va. I'm Sharad Kutin with Brian Fernandez. And joining us, Tan Chung Han, who speaks Spanish, apparently. Oi Como Va, what does that mean?
My way to put me on the spot here, I do not know what Oi Como Va is.
Really?
But I did take a year of Spanish in college.
Muy bien.
Buenos días a todos.
Must have been cake then for you. If you can't tell us what that means.
Yeah. Well, it's been many, many years. So, yeah.
Okay. Sorry for putting you in the spot, dude. But in the spot, of course, in the spotlight, the UK elections, we have some results already trickling in. Remember, 650 seats at stake, Theresa May's prime ministership at stake in this election, and perhaps the strong message she wanted to send Europe about domestic support for her as she negotiates tough with her continental you know, buddies. They're now looking really like a very shaky scenario ahead for her. Exit polls already having a drubbing effect on the pound. The pound dropped with the exit polls that suggest 341 seats for the Tories or Conservative Party, which is 12 short of the 326 that they need.
You mean
314.
Yeah. You know, so in short here, it looks like the exit polls seem to suggest that the UK could be headed for a hung parliament, or as ING calls it, maximum chaos. That's what they're calling it.
According to my numbers, if they get 314, the Greens and the Welsh have parties actually have 22 seats. And if that happens, a coalition could be formed.
Yeah, well, I think that's the uncertainty there,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, so no, it's okay. the Welsh Party pledged Cymru and the Greens and other parties all together have about 22 seats, yes. And the major part, the other major parties, Labour, SNP, the Scottish Nationalist Party and the Lib Dems together have 314, exactly the same, according to the exit polls, exactly the same as the Conservatives.
Yeah, no, so looking from a markets perspective, you know, you had the pound falling by the most since October. You know, yesterday it was at 129.5. It dropped down to 127. 1.275 rather. Sorry, I apologize. So from 1.295 to 1.275, that's what, 2 basis points. Although it has pared some of its losses right now, now above 1.28. So we'll be getting some market reaction from not just Tim Mulholland, who is the president of TGM Limited out of Chicago, but we'll also be speaking to Jamil Ahmad, who is the vice president of corporate development and market research with Forex Time. But I think the broader question is this, though. You know, again, depending on the official results, what we are talking about right now is the what the exit polls seem to suggest. But depending on the official results, is the UK set for another bout of political uncertainty? I think that's going to be weighing on the minds of investors and also the UK population, and basically the globe.
Yeah, and after the 8:30 news, we'll be also speaking to an analyst down in Singapore about the UK elections. So it's a full day of UK elections, despite some really important domestic news, including the sentencing to death of 9 Filipinos for the Lahad Datu incursion, mm-hmm. also set to create tensions and uncertainties in the Sulu Sea area.
Sure. Now, on the local business front, we'll give you some quick updates on Felda Global Ventures. And yet again, so we've got the paper, the business papers today talking about or giving us some updates. So you've got the MACC. They spent 8 hours searching the HQ or FGV, and they searched the floors of which house the office of the CFO and also the CEO, rather the floors which houses the offices of the CFO and CEO. So we also gave you some brief statements from Tan Sri Sharir. He's the chairman of Felda, and also Dato Sri Idris Jala. We'll get into that more after 7:45 a.m.
Also, we have news about the Malaysian retail industry. It records, 1.2% sales growth in the first quarter of 2017. Is that significant, 1.2%?
Well, actually, it's 1.2% drop in sales, actually, in the first quarter. So if you're thinking of doing a bit of shopping over the weekend, well, you know, I guess here's something to keep in mind, at least in the first 3 months of this year. You know, things didn't go so well. Looks like things were slow during the past Chinese New Year. So if you want to know what the outlook is for all of 2017, again, we'll let you know after 7:45 a.m. today.
Yeah, we're coming up to the top of the hour with the news, and then after that, we'll be back with more analysis. BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.